Hey listeners, this is Travis Book, bassist and singer in the bluegrass band The Infamous String Dusters. I started the Travis Book Happy Hour to try to get to the root of what makes my contemporaries tick, what inspires and motivates them, and why they make music. It's an hour where we get to play together, talk about life, and do it all in front of a live studio audience. If you haven't listened yet, maybe check out some of my highlights, including Sierra Hull, Beppe Gambetta, Tim O'Brien, and Lindsay Liu. You can find every episode of the Travis Book Happy Hour on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network or wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. It's me, Cindy House, here with Lizzie No.
Well, hey, Cindy.
Hi. Before we get into our fun time chats, I just want to say that if you want to keep in touch with Basic Folk, you can sign up for our newsletter at basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We are on all the major platforms. I don't think we're on
all of them.
TikTok. Are you on TikTok?
I'm on TikTok. My handle is Ask Me About Imagine Dragons.
Okay.
I can't believe that was available.
Do you post regularly on TikTok?
No. I go through phases. Like if I'm feeling very silly, I'll do some TikToks. And it's also really good for videos of my dog.
Great. All right. So
it's pretty delightful.
Once again, that handle is Ask Me About Imagine Dragons.
And I want to make it clear it's not because I'm a fan of Imagine Dragons.
It's quite the opposite.
Nothing could be farther from the truth.
Wow. So we have Ken Yates on the podcast today. Very excited to listen to Elizabeth and Kenneth discuss many different topics. Before we get into Ken, what's going on with your music?
Thank you for asking, because moments before we started recording this, I was like, Cindy, this is going to be the episode where I finally remember to promote my own music. And then I promptly forgot. I have new music out. I have a new single out called Sweeter Than Strychnine on Coal Mine Records and Palmetto Street Records. If I do say so myself, it's very, very good. It's like an old school R&B soul thing. And it's my first time releasing vinyl. So I'm super proud of it. It's very fun, kind of girl groupy, kind of like Bond villainy.
Yeah. It's not exactly spaghetti western, but it has that kind of like retro
vibe. Close enough.
It's very cool.
Thank you, Cindy.
And where can people find that?
They can stream it on any of my pages on Spotify or Apple Music. That's Lizzie No. On Tidal, Spotify, Bandcamp, all of those things. Or if you go to the Coal Mine Records website, you can order the 7-inch vinyl in red or black.
Maybe we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, send me your money. I'll send you a record.
I can't remember who I was interviewing one time, and they were talking about something, and then they said, oh yeah, we'll put that in the show notes.
The guest said that?
Yeah.
That's not appropriate.
I want to say it was like Dietrich or something. Yeah, it was Dietrich.
Okay, Dietrich.
Dietrich Strauss.
Dietrich is an honorary producer of the show.
We've been rewatching Grey's Anatomy.
My stepson just started Grey's Anatomy season one.
Oh, really?
Imagine being 13 years old and starting Grey's Anatomy in 2022. It's a trip. His conclusion is like, it seems so amazing to be a doctor because you're in a community of so many friends. And I was like, I'm not a doctor, but I just like don't know if that's actually the accurate takeaway, but I love this for you.
That is a nice takeaway.
What's new with you, Cindy?
Not an ad, but they opened a new Whole Foods in Pittsburgh, and I really feel like my
wow.
life is worth living now. They have like, so I was really into this hop tea. It's like sparkling tea.
Oh, that sounds great.
The old Whole Foods would sell it by the can. This Whole Foods sells it by the case. And I am
That's game changing, Cindy.
Totally game changing. They also have hop water, which I went to California earlier this year.
Oh, yeah.
And had some hop water, Lagunitas.
Like Lagunita? Yeah. I love Lagunitas.
So good. And it's like, I mean, you're not drinking a beer, but it's like kind of close to drinking a beer.
Close enough.
Close enough.
I like the Lagunitas fake IPAs. I have those in my fridge.
Mm, you know what? I respect that. And I respect people who like non-alcoholic beer. But like, I don't think I like it. I don't really love beer in general. And also like this beer kind of like doesn't get you drunk. And it still kind of makes me feel like I'm drinking a beer like the next day. My brother and I were talking about this one night. And he was like, if I drink more than two of these, I have a hangover. To me, it's like not worth it. Unless it's like, it's a sunny day, you're sitting by the water, and somebody hands you a cool NA beer.
I feel like I don't drink more than one non-alcoholic beer. I feel like it's just to have a drink.
Yeah. At my wedding, I had a champagne flute full of bubbly rosé when we were like getting ready, and I wasn't drinking it. I was just holding it, and it was the same experience.
Yes, that's so important to have, because at a wedding, people are going to hand you a lot of drinks, I imagine. My only touch point for this is being a musician, which is, I assume, the same as being a bride. Like when it's your show and people are like, good job to you. We're here to see you. Here's a free drink. It's got to be like playing a show times 50.
I want to actually bring up an important point. When I'm at a show and the musician on stage is like, can someone get me a drink? I get so anxious because I'm like, 10 people are going to get them a drink. And there's going to be too many drinks.
That has happened to me. Yes. Once I played this show in Chicago, and not to brag, it was extremely crowded, dare I say sold out. And so I actually could not get to the bar. Like even if we had, I think even when there was a little break, I could not get from the stage to the bar because it was so full of fans. Shout out to Lavender Country and Paisley Fields and Austin Lucas for a very successful tour. So I was like, I think I had a beer in my hand and I just said like, hey, could anyone grab me a drink? And I had 7 drinks. And the most chaotic part was that they were all different drinks. Like one person brought me a mixed cocktail. Multiple people brought me different types of beer. The cool thing about that was like at the end of the show, I was able to be like an open bar for my loved ones. Like friends of mine were like, oh, maybe I'll get a drink. And I was like, I have this rum and coke, or I have this Truly seltzer, or I have this IPA, or I have this Sierra Nevada. Like I had a variety of drinks to hand out.
My solution for that would be like for you to be on stage and be like, hey, guy in the hat, can you get me, like point out a specific person? But if they can't physically get to the bar because there's too many people, it's just not possible.
Wait, that's actually really fun. I love the idea of putting somebody else on the spot. Because when you're performing, it's like people are looking at you and then you turn it around on them. Like, hey, you.
I find that people love attention.
Are you contributing to this? Bring me a drink.
Hey, you over there. Hey, you fella.
Hey. Hey, cowboy. Statistically, you make more money than I do because of your gender and your height. Bring me a drink.
Wonderful. Speaking of that, do you want to talk about Ken Yates?
I do. I had never met him before I did this interview. And then a few days after, he showed up at my house for a stoop beer. It was very fun. Yeah, he's a great guy. Ken grew up in the college town of London, Ontario. And I like to think of him as Canada's next top model, by which I mean he is wonderfully talented, disarmingly nice, and from Canada. Obviously, he is a Berklee College of Music graduate. And I took the opportunity to ask him about that experience, sort of the why would somebody go to music school? What were you hoping to gain? What did you actually get out of it? All of these things are fascinating to me whenever we have a guest that is a conservatory graduate. Ken's answers were really interesting. And one takeaway that I got from his story of going to Berklee is that like even some of the most talented, most well-prepared people feel like they have no idea what they're doing and are looking to their friends to be like, okay, how are you planning out your life? Ken had a breakout album in 2016 called Huntsville, which earned him the Emerging Artist of the Year Award at the Canadian Folk Music Awards. A huge honor, very competitive. And also, this was a defining moment where Ken was kind of externally told, you are a folk artist. So we got a chance to talk about what that means and what the genre means to him. Ken's album Quiet Talkers, which came out in 2020, is so beautiful. That was my introduction to his music. Obviously, because of the release date, instead of touring in support of that album, he did a bunch of COVID-era online shows. And as an onlooker, I was so impressed with how gracious and level-headed he was about basically touring online only, and just like how generous he was with his audience in spite of the crappy circumstances. And he has this emotional awareness and level-headedness and grace that make him a really interesting writer. And that kind of leads us to the big cathartic project of Cerulean, which is his new 2022 album that we spent a lot of our time talking about in the interview. Cerulean is such a gorgeous album, so impeccably written, and it bridges the gap between folk and indie rock, between skepticism and hope, between the pain of losing someone and the acceptance of the circumstances around you. It has a distinct groove, a distinct sound, and it features vocals from Americana stars like Kathleen Edwards, Liz Longley, and Katie Pruitt, and it has some of the prettiest production that I've heard all year. So Ken was just a joy to talk with, and we got to talk about pets and home offices and a lot of other fun stuff. So he's a really, really cool songwriter, and I think you're going to love this album.
All right, let's take a listen to a song from his latest record. This is Consolation Prize featuring Katie Pruitt, known Catholic lesbian Katie Pruitt. She has her own podcast about being Catholic.
Really?
Yes.
Known Catholic lesbian.
Yes.
That's a great album title.
Yes. Katie Pruitt, use that idea. It's a free idea. Okay, let's hear it. This is Ken Yates' Consolation Prize, and then we'll get to Lizzie's conversation with Ken on Basic Folk.
Hello, welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I am Lizzie No, and I am so excited to be here with Ken Yates. Thank you for talking with me, Ken.
Thanks for having me. Nice to meet you.
I'm going to jump right in. We were talking off mic about puppies, and we'll probably get back into that later.
Yeah.
But I want to start with your life and your music. So you grew up in London, Ontario.
That's right, yep.
My sense is that that's like a university town. Did you have music classes in your school? Was there a big music scene there with your friends? Like, set the scene for us.
Not really, no. I mean, you're right. It's a university town. There's a big university there. And that's really about it. That's all I can really say about London. there's not too much else going on there. There's not much of a music scene there when I was in high school. It's a little bit mm-hmm. better now, but it's still kind of a weird town in terms of like a music scene. It's still very much like, it's kind of a no man's land. It's in between Toronto and Detroit, really. So even
okay.
artists who are touring don't really stop there a lot. But yeah, when I was in high school, I was really just like played guitar in my basement. Like I didn't have many musician friends.
Oh
it was
gosh.
Just sort of a thing I did on my own.
So how did you get into it? Like, how did you get the idea in your mind? Like, I'm going to be a singer-songwriter. Like, where did this come from?
Honestly, most of it came from just like pure delusion at that point. Like mm-hmm. I, you know, because I had no reference of like how good I was, cause I just played guitar in my basement. I just loved it. Mm-hmm. I knew I loved it. I knew, you know, around 17, 18, I knew I wanted to like pursue music, but again, it was mm-hmm. kind of delusional. I had no idea what that meant. I knew I just liked to play guitar and I knew I loved music, and I had never written a song. I wasn't a singer. But I just had this complete delusion that I wanted to get out of London and I wanted to go to Berklee College of Music, and I knew mm-hmm. nothing about Berklee in Boston. but I had mentioned it to my parents. And obviously, looking back now, I'm very appreciative for them, because I think they thought it would be character building to at least take me down there and audition and, you know, try to get a feel for what it might be like to move to the States, try to be around, you know, other musicians and just go through that process. And, you know, I don't think they'd admit this, but I'm pretty sure they didn't think I was going to get in.
So that's incredible. No, that's, I think that's good parenting. Like, even if you're not sure if it's going to work out, like doing the, like, tell your kid to do the thing, at least give it a shot.
Yeah.
I feel like I ask this, we've had a few guests who've like gone to music school, who've come on the podcast. And I feel like I ask this of everyone, like, what was your conception of what Berklee was going to do for you? Like, some people take the path of just like right out of high school, move to Nashville, start writing songs. But getting your degree is like a very different path. So what was your concept of what that was going to do in your big picture?
When I first went there, I mean, I really knew nothing about the school. And again, I was just a guitar player. So I think I just thought that I would go there and I would perfect my guitar skills and I would be an amazing guitar player and, you know, meet some people and start a band and world domination after that.
Great.
Of course. And then I got there and was kind of like, oh, okay, well, this is my first time being around a whole community of artists, and a lot of them already like very polished, and a lot of them knowing what they want to do with their careers, a lot of them like on the production side or the songwriting side or the business side. And here I was just a basement guitar player having no idea what I wanted to do. So the first few years were actually kind of tough for me, because I realized that, you know, I was certainly not the best guitar player at the school. There's some amazing players who go there. And
I bet there were a handful of other people that knew what they were doing on guitar. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And just people who just knew, like, they just had a goal, right? Like, they knew what they wanted their careers to look like. And I just didn't really know what that looked like. So the first few years were really just me experimenting, taking different courses and just figuring out what I wanted to do. And Berklee's very, very jazz heavy at the time. Yes. It was, I think it's less jazz heavy now, but, I took a bunch of like jazz courses and hated that. I took a few like vocal courses and piano courses and just kind of bounced around a little bit. And then your third year at Berklee is usually where you start picking a major. And so I still had no idea what I wanted to do. And just kind of on a whim, I took a songwriting course and I said like, well, if I actually want to have a future in music, like maybe I should try writing a song. And my first songwriting class, I just assumed that we would just be listening to other songs and dissecting what makes songs good and, you know, learning rhymes and structure and stuff. But the first week, the professor was just like, you know, bring in a song next week and everyone's going to play their song and we're all going to talk about it. And I was like, holy shit. Okay.
Oh my God.
I've never written a song. So I spent the next week.
What did you do?
I spent the next week in absolute, like, I was just terrified, and I wrote a really terrible song.
What was it about?
I think it was called Flying Bicycle, and yeah, it was really bad.
Like E.T.?
Yeah, like E.T., and I think it was about how I was in a long-distance relationship with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, so it worked out.
Aww,
but
Ken.
Yeah, I think it was about how I wish I had a bicycle that I could fly. In hindsight, it made no sense. Like, why not a plane?
We have the technology now.
Yeah, we have the technology. I don't know why it had to be a bicycle. But to my classmates' credit, they were very kind about it. And we kept doing this exercise of bringing songs in. And the songs gradually started getting a little bit better. And I started getting a little bit more confident. But it's funny in hindsight that I just kind of took this course on a whim. And yeah. Because who knows if I would have even written a song without taking that course, which is kind of crazy looking back.
Do you still seek out feedback from people when you're drafting your songs? Or are you the type of person who like wants to have it all polished before you bring it to a band or peers?
I have one person who I go to for feedback. That's Brian Dunn, your friend Brian Dunn. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, okay, we're 10 minutes into the interview. I was wondering how long we were going to be able to go before we brought up Brian Dunn. Shout out to Brian Dunn, fellow Berkeley alum and dear friend of mine. When you were talking about like going to Berkeley and meeting people who like really knew what they wanted and knew what they were doing, I was like, that's Brian Dunn to a T.
Yes.
As soon as absolutely. I met him, I was like, this is the most having their shit together person I've ever met in music.
Yes. And Brian was like right when I started writing songs, he was already like, he went to Berkeley for songwriting. He knew mm-hmm. the kind of artist he wanted to be. And I was sort of blown away by his like confidence and his drive and his, and he was really one of the first people who were like, hey man, you're not bad. You should keep doing this.
You got something going on.
Yeah. So, yeah. Then that's when I really like, I wish I had found these people earlier in my life because I think I just hadn't really found the right community up until that mm-hmm. point. So once I found that songwriting community, I was like, oh, these are my people. This is where I belong.
Dude, I think a lot of people, I mean, we kind of as a culture understand that image of like, the lonely person in their basement making a record at night. I think people don't realize just how many people and how many resources it takes to make an album.
Yeah.
Or to put a tour together. And like, if you don't have a lot of people who are willing to like lend you favors and you get them back the next time, you just don't have a chance. Like you actually have to make friends to be able to do anything in music.
And it's crazy. I was so green. I was so like, I had mm-hmm. no idea what making an album looked like. I didn't know what people did in a studio. Like I just had no idea. And so Brian was one of those people. And then a few other people, this guy, Joran, who wanted to get into mm-hmm. production. He was in one of my classes and he said like, hey man, I'd like to try and make an EP with you. And, I like your stuff. And I was like, okay. And I was just blown away by the process. I was like, you can edit my vocals. Like you can take two different takes and put them together. Like I had no clue.
That's actually not a confirmed fact. And for any of the listeners who might be wondering if any of the Lizzie No albums have had vocal edits, they never have. Right. I do it all in one take.
Yeah. No, there's I no do tuning, too now.
And
course.
There's no comping. Yeah. No just comping. One take.
Just one take of everything. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So how did you make your way from that point to recording 23, your first album?
So some of the songs that were on that first EP ended up on mm-hmm. 23. So I did that with the same producer, Joran. Cool. We all moved to New York after graduating. We moved to Greenpoint. There was me and three other songwriter kids from Berkeley who all wanted to be pop songwriters. It was terrible.
Wow.
It was a terrible environment to live in as like a folk singer-songwriter.
I wanted to talk about Huntsville, which is such a great album. And really, like, if I'm kind of reading the historical record correctly, like set you on this incredible upward trajectory where you were named Best New Artist at the Canadian Folk Music Awards. Was that around the time that you realized people were calling you a folk artist? Like how did you conceptualize your genre at that time in 2016?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think so. I think Huntsville is probably my folkiest album. And mm-hmm. in hindsight, it's kind of funny that it's so folky because I never really thought of myself as a folk artist.
Right.
But I think it was just the nature of my lifestyle at the moment, which was that's when I really started hitting the road hard and trying to make a living at, you know, being a full-time artist. And the doors that were available to me at the time were doing like a lot of private shows, like house concerts and, sure. you know, living room shows. And that was how I was surviving and making money. And I think in a weird way, a lot of those shows kind of dictated the style of the music in a strange yes. way. Like I would have loved to tour with a band, but it just didn't financially make sense. So it was mm-hmm. just me driving around with my acoustic guitar and playing in living rooms. And I think the songs kind of catered to that kind of audience after a while, which is funny thinking back because I was never, you know, folk music wasn't really the genre that I listened to, like, growing up. So
what did you listen to more than anything?
You know, I was into like Radiohead, and mm-hmm. I was into like Sufjan Stevens, which I guess like has a folky,
yeah, sure,
folky influence to it. So I was, you know, I was certainly like influenced by some of that folkiness, but never the like hardcore folkies, you know, of like
we all know hardcore folkies, and I'm scared of them. No, we love them. Yeah. We love all hardcore folkies.
I love them too.
And softcore folkies.
Yes, yes, absolutely. But yeah, looking back at writing Huntsville, it was strange to me because I was trying to write songs like The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald or something. Like I was trying to take stories and write them, like, you know, look just from looking at a newspaper or something, you know? So yeah, which I still love a lot of those songs on that record, mm-hmm. but I'm definitely confused why it ended up so folky, but I think it was just the nature of my circumstance at that time.
How do you think the reception of that album like steered where you went from there?
Well, I mean, it definitely put me in the like white guy with an acoustic guitar category, which, yeah, you know, it isn't a bad place to be. And you know, that was just, my audience became kind of those older folkies. And, mm-hmm. but I got really burnt out of doing those living room shows. Me and Brian were touring a lot together at the time and doing and kind of joining forces and booking those mm-hmm. kinds of shows together. And both of us just got completely burnt out of that kind of show. And
what do you think is hard about it? Cause I have my own ideas having done some of those shows, but I'm curious what your experience was like.
I think after a while it started feeling like babysitting.
Yeah.
It started feeling like I was, even because, you know, when you're playing in a living room to a bunch of people, like you've got to engage with them and you've got to tell stories and you've got to be, and a lot of them have never heard you before. So you're just trying to mm-hmm. keep them engaged in this very strange setting. And I found myself getting tired of hearing myself talk. Like I was pandering to them. I felt like I was pandering. I felt like the songs I was writing were aimed at these types of audiences. I even wrote, like I had songs that I wrote about house concert experiences. And I think I just got a little, I felt like I was not really being myself, I think, you know. Mm-hmm. And I also learned that after a while, like I thought that I was building something, where really like those shows were great to make money and to make a living, but it wasn't translating into people coming to shows at like a venue, you know. It was, they weren't becoming like followers or fans. They were just, you know, they were people's neighbors from down the street that they happened to invite, right? So I just didn't feel like it was leading to anywhere. So there were a few years where it just felt like I was spinning my wheels a little bit. And at first it was great because I was making money and I felt like I was mm-hmm. doing it, you know, and we were traveling all over the country. So I felt like, you know, I was real troubadour, I was really doing it. And then a few years later, it was just kind of like, well, I don't know where this is all leading. So, you know,
yeah. I too many windows and not enough doors.
Yeah, exactly.
Someone once said.
Yes.
Listeners, it was Ken that said it. I actually had a thought about that song because the first time I listened to it, Too Many Windows, beautiful song off the Huntsville album, I was a little bit stoned. And what I heard was, too many nice guys, not enough stars.
Nice guys, yeah.
Instead of too many night skies. Yeah. So I pictured like a music video, and you can use this. This is a free idea to you.
Sweet.
You, like, imagine you are a talent agent who works in an open plan office that's like surrounded by glass, so there's way too many windows and not enough doors. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at the headshots that came in, and it's too many nice guys and not enough stars. Like, you're looking for the next Brad Pitt.
Right.
And all you're getting is that Parks and Rec guy that nobody likes anymore.
Just a bunch of nice guys, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, just a bunch of nice guys.
You know, story of my life. That's great. I'm going to take that. I never made a video for that song, so, you know.
It's not too late.
I
can't help because I don't know how to do anything related to a music video, but
well,
the concept is yours for free.
Yeah. We'll make sure.
I was hoping you'd be game to do like a little bit of a case study because I've been listening really intently to the way that you put songs together. And I think it's really, really interesting. Like, if we can jump into Quiet Talkers, which came out in 2020. One of my favorite songs is Two Wrongs. There's like a really tricky use of homophones with the number two, the adverb two. But I think what's really remarkable about that song, and a lot of the songs on that album, are how you kind of just say the really hard thing, say the direct thing, without it sounding cliche. So like, as an example, there's a lyric that goes, "When my life went off the tracks, I had a panic attack. You still had my back. Your loving was easy." And that really struck me because there are a lot of people that are, I think, trying to do that, but coming across really schmaltzy, a little bit fake. But there's something very authentic about the way that that's phrased. So how do you write a song like that? How do you know when you've said enough, but not over embellished? Do you write and rewrite? Do you edit a lot? Like, walk me through the lyrics, writing lyrics like that.
Yeah, I do a lot of editing. It's interesting mm-hmm. that you brought up that song because that's one of the only songs where when I listen back, I do almost cringe a little bit thinking that it maybe is borderline, you know, it's borderline on the cliche there. I'm really walking a fine line with that one.
I think you're good.
Okay.
But that's just one woman's opinion. Yeah.
Okay. That's good. I feel better now. I do a lot of editing. I think with that album, with Quiet Talkers and with the new one, I always found that I tried to be too tricky with my songwriting.
Okay.
I always tried to have that like really tricky turn of phrase mm-hmm. at the end of the chorus or something. And it's something that I've been trying to get away from because it does kind of walk that line on being cliche. I mostly just try to turn the editor's brain off when I'm writing and then go back mm-hmm. to the lyrics after and tweak away as much as possible and give myself some space from it. Like I take mm-hmm. I just spend a lot of time on lyrics. Like I usually have the song pretty quickly, and then I just have to keep stepping away and coming back to it. But yeah, that was one in particular where I was like, I think I'm walking that line here. So
I have one more question before we dig into the new album, Cerulean. You did a lot of online shows, live streams during 2020, and you had like just put a new album out and never got a chance to like tour it that year, like a lot of artists. Like all the interviews I've read that you did from that time, you were a total class act, full of gratitude and perspective. But like, what was it really like to release an album with all that goes into it and then perform online? Like, what did that feel like?
Oh, it sucked. It was terrible. Yeah. No, I hated it. I'm glad that I came across as pretty positive, but it's still like, I still think about it. I just think about that record I put out in 2020 was mm-hmm. pretty good for the most part. And I feel like it didn't really have a life, and I would have loved to given it more of a life, and hopefully it still will have one. Like I'm realizing now that I'm going back out on the road that people are hearing these songs for the first time, and I almost forgot. Like I'll play songs from Quiet Talkers and be like, oh, I've never played this in this city before, and people,
oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. And so that's exciting, like people, you know, realizing that, oh yeah, people were listening to this record, I just maybe didn't experience that firsthand, because if you're not playing live, you can't really see the music working in real time, right? Like you're not getting direct feedback. You're getting some feedback from social media, but you're not getting that direct feedback.
Right. And I always find that that I perform songs differently over time as I get feedback from audiences. And it's interesting that a record like Quiet Talkers could just be sort of frozen in time mm-hmm. and not get that like journey of changing what the songs sound like live. That's really interesting. I hope I get to see you live, and I would be interested to see what it is like to see those songs now when they like sat in the internet for 2 years.
Well, it's been kind of exciting because I am kind of reworking how I would play them because I never played them live. Whereas like Huntsville, I had played those mm-hmm. songs on the road for like years before I recorded them. So they were very much like, I play them a specific way every single time. Whereas these two new records, I'm still kind of figuring out how to play them. And I play them differently every night, it feels like. And that's kind of mm-hmm. exciting, and it's kind of fun. And that was a fun part of making them too, is just not having, you know, hammering them live every night and it being a bit more fresh and a bit more like just figuring out like different guitar parts and stuff. And
yeah.
So it's been kind of nice to to get back out there. And hopefully the new one will have a life too, because it very much still feels like a pandemic record, but.
Yikes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about Cerulean, this great new album. First of all, like just talking about that recording process, it was a different scenario than your previous records, correct? Like you were recording this remotely. Can you talk us through like what that actually looks like, making an album when the producer is not in the same room with you?
Yeah. So Jim Bryson, who's done the last three records, he did Huntsville, Quiet Talkers, and Cerulean. And we found a few days in between lockdowns here in Ontario. He lives about 4 hours east of me. He's in Ottawa area. And so we found a few days to get in his studio with a band and just get the basic tracks recorded. And then he basically gave me a vocal mic to bring home, and he gave me some recording gear and was like, hey, you can try to do all the vocals and some guitar stuff from home. And I really had no knowledge of recording myself. But I mean, wow. I could make demos and stuff, but I never thought I could make like studio quality recordings.
So how did you learn to record your voice at home?
So just with Jim's help and the internet, I kind of figured it out, and I set up a closet and kind of turned it into a little vocal booth and bought some more gear. And actually it was kind of enjoyable figuring all that out. And
cool.
I call it the pain cave. I would go in there every night. My wife and I would like finish dinner and I'd be like, all right, going up to the pain cave. You won't see me again tonight. And I would just do like 20 takes of a song and then
yikes,
like, you know, spend the rest of the night editing it. Well, not editing, as you said, I mean, just listening to the one perfect vocal take.
Brutal.
But
just the one,
just
it
one.
All happens all at once, folks.
Yeah.
That's the one part of making an album that's completely seamless.
Yeah.
So I read that did you move to a new place that had a home office?
Yeah, we moved about a year ago out to the country, from Toronto.
So it reminded me of how in a room of one's own, Virginia Woolf says that intellectual freedom depends upon material conditions. And I would love for you to describe for our listeners, what does your home office look like? And how has it changed how you work?
Yeah, I mean, my home office, which I call a studio, which nobody else would call a studio because it is not. It's basically just a room full of random stuff, which you're looking at right now.
Well, I live in Brooklyn. I would describe it as a studio for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I love having this space. It's been a total game changer. Just to like leave the mic set up and leave everything on and to be able to sit down and everything's on when you're feeling creative, whereas I used to have to kind of pull everything out of a closet, set it up and put it away. And honestly, I'm kind of amazed at how I wrote songs in like past conditions, because I would just have to find little times, little periods where I could write, whereas now I have a space I can go to and spend a lot of time in here. So it's been a game changer, honestly. And I've learned a lot about recording myself, and, my demos are sounding better, and I think I can actually like make somewhat studio quality things from here. So it's kind of been fun.
I would describe the vocal recording on Cerulean as studio quality at the very least.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear it.
I read a really interesting, was it an interview or a quote in your bio where you said, this is the first time that I've made a record where I feel like the songs were going to be written whether I wanted to release an album or not. I was writing because I needed to. I never would have described songwriting as a cathartic process in the past. It was just something I liked to do. So when did you start writing this group of songs? And when did it become clear that an album was taking shape?
Yeah, so I started writing this record basically right at the start of the pandemic. So yeah, like March 2020. Yeah. Like that quote says, I think I had only written in the past when I was in a good mood. Like anytime I was in a terrible mood, I found I could never write anything. That's not when the creative juices were flowing. They were always flowing when I was in like a good headspace, even though I was writing pretty dark stuff.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Whereas this record, I found it hard to write when the pandemic started, because I was in a very dark place and, you know, I was going through some tough family stuff. My mom was sick. And so I couldn't write at all because I was just in this kind of really, really bad space. But, you know, like I was mentioning before, I just kind of started working through some of that stuff, like actually, you know, facing up to some of my inner darkness for the first time, maybe. Yes, thank you.
That was applause.
Yep.
People can't see me. It's an audio medium.
Yeah. Sometimes which I think a lot of people were doing over the pandemic, right? Is like, yes. There's no distraction from it. I think I realized a lot of the touring I had done the past few years were just a way to like feel busy and to avoid certain things, certain mm-hmm. darknesses going on. And so I had nothing but time to face it. And the songs started coming. And once that started flowing, I wrote them all within a 3 or 4 month period. And wow. I knew within a couple of months that I had another album taking shape. And I also didn't really want to wait to make it because I felt like those few months were such an important snapshot of what I was going through. And the songs themselves on Cerulean are basically the track list is in order of how I wrote them too. So it's kind of this mm-hmm. timeline of where I was at that point. So I felt like I needed to, I felt like I needed to do something. So I was like, well, I have these songs, so I gotta make them. But it was also, it was a revelation to know that I wasn't just making songs to make a record, to put out, to, you know, make a living. It was like, oh, this is just what I do, I think. I write songs. You know, they would be written whether I wanted to put out an album or not. So that was a interesting time for me, just figuring out like, this is just kind of what I do. Like these, I had no control. These songs would have been written. So it was kind of, kind of a revelation for me.
Yeah. It was just a state of being mm-hmm. rather than like a goal oriented activity.
Yeah. Which I think makes for better songs in my honest opinion. I think because I turned off that side of my brain, which was like, you know, when you're an emerging artist, I'm doing air quotes because mm-hmm. I've been emerging for 12 years.
We're all emerging. We're all emerging. We are all emerging.
Yeah. When you're an emerging artist, sometimes it feels like every song you write needs to be the one that gets you mm-hmm. noticed, right? So I definitely struggle with that with Quiet Talkers, just thinking like there's songs on there that I thought like, could this be like a pop hit? Like, which is insane that I was thinking that, but there's songs on there that I'd like to roommates. Take back. Yeah, it's those roommates, exactly. And I can't believe I was even thinking, like having that thought, right? There's a song called Anchor and Sail on mm-hmm. Quiet Talkers, which I think is...
That's such a pretty song.
It's a nice song, but you know, it makes me cringe a little bit just thinking about what I thought of it. I thought like, oh, we'll put it at the back of the record and it's kind of this like pop song that maybe people will find and be like, ooh, that's a hit.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
You know what? That can still happen.
It's true.
I wish you the millions that you deserve from that track.
Thank you.
Can you talk me through the decision to sequence the songs in the order they were written? Because that is unusual and it really makes for an interesting story on the album.
Yeah, it wasn't intentional. I think we recorded the songs kind of out of order. And then once I was making the track list, I realized that I had made it that way. Mm-hmm. So it was completely unintentional. But once I really didn't know what the album was about until we had finished recording and until once I started making a track listing and thinking about what the overall theme was, I kind of went like, oh, okay, well, this is kind of a timeline of what I was going through. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I knew it at the time when I was writing it. So yeah, it just kind of happened like that.
Did you have a blueprint in your mind of how you wanted the album to sound before you went into the studio, or did a lot of it happen in those few like sessions with the band that you were able to do?
Yeah, I had a pretty good idea of how I wanted it to sound. I felt like with Quiet Talkers, I had one foot still in the folky singer-songwriter world and one mm-hmm. foot stepping forward into more of this kind of indie folk territory, if mm-hmm. if you know, for lack of a better word. And so I knew I kind of wanted to keep going with that kind of more indie direction. And I was writing a lot of the new songs on electric guitar, so that I think they naturally stepped away from the folkiness. And but that was definitely a deliberate thing with Jim. I definitely wanted it to be less folky and more full band and more guitars, more synths, more of everything. Mm-hmm. I think with Huntsville, I kind of held Jim back because I had been playing those songs solo for so long. I was like, okay, we don't need to add much to it. And anytime mm-hmm. he got a little crazy with synths and stuff, I was like, whoa, slow it down there, buddy.
I used to have a no synths rule because I was afraid I'd be kicked out of the folk club. Yeah, and now that is out the window.
Well, I was just afraid that it would totally change the sound of my music, which is crazy in hindsight. And that's the beauty of working with a producer, more time, like two or three times, is I knew that no matter how much stuff we added, how many synths and how many, you know, electronic drums and how many we put congas on this album, like I knew that it was still going to sound like me. They're my songs. It is me singing them and it's me playing them. So I could literally put, you know, anything on these songs and it would not be a complete diversion from what I've been doing my whole life, right?
Yeah. One thing that really stands out to me with this album is that, like, it has some really confessional and intimate storytelling, but the whole thing grooves. And I want to know, like, how did you build that rhythm section? And was that a part of your, like, folk departure? Talk me through the movement of it.
Yeah. I think I was trying to make a record, even though the theme was very dark, lyrically it was very dark. I wanted to make a record that I could also put on, you know, when I'm making dinner, you know, which I don't know if it is a record people will put on when they're making dinner, but I find the records that I'm drawn to, even if they have heavy subject matter, I want them to sonically sound a certain way. Like I kind of want to be put in that world and not have too much variation, I guess. Like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to find a good way to describe this, but...
Well, no, that makes sense because it's somewhere in between, like, you listen alone in headphones, like, sitting on the bus, mm-hmm. and, like, a whole group of people would be wildly dancing. Like, the dinner-making record is a record that grooves a little bit and you can sort of move your hips a little bit while doing something else.
Right.
So it's like a moderate groove.
Yeah. I guess I find that even some of my favorite songwriters, like, I don't put their records on because, you know, you've got the loud song, you've got the rocker, and then you've got the really quiet acoustic ballad. And I just find that variation sometimes bothers me. Whereas at the time I was listening to a lot of, like, Kurt Vile, I was listening to a lot of War on Drugs.
War on Drugs.
They just kind of put you in this space and you never leave the space. And it's just kind of this steady groove that I love. And
the Weather Station is that way as well.
Yeah,
Weather Station. Like, you put on a Weather Station album and it's just like, you could just walk sort of mindlessly and soulfully for like an hour.
Yeah, I love her so much. And I've been listening to this guy, Lee Fullback. Do you ever listen to him?
Oh, he's fantastic.
I put on his record so much because it sounds like they literally just pressed record and just play the whole album. And I just love being in that space with them. And so it was a little bit conscious. There were songs like Consolation Prize from the new record that
featuring Katie Pruitt. It's a beautiful song. Yeah.
And I remember the band being like, okay, I'm thinking no drums for this, or maybe just like a kick drum or whatever. And I was like, no, let's keep the drums in the whole thing. Let's just keep it going. We can always take the drums out, which we did on a couple of songs. We took drums out on Best of the Broken Things. But I just kind of wanted that. I didn't want that song to just be like, okay, here's the quiet ballad that everyone's going to have to turn up when that song comes on because it's so much quieter than the others, right? Like, it's
so annoying.
It's almost a volume thing for me. It's just like, I don't want to have to change the dial too much, right?
No, whether literally or spiritually.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, you know, the darkness on the record. Like, you're talking a lot about what it was like to watch your mom's health decline. That's extremely intimate. I would find it maybe almost impossible to talk about. So did you ever have reservations about, like, taking something that's so personal and sharing it with strangers?
Yeah, honestly, it was hard to talk about this record at first. And that's where the like actual real therapy kind of helped me kind of parse through talking about it, which I started doing basically after I finished this record. But
hey, good for you.
Thanks.
Therapy is great.
It's great. Everybody should do it. even if you mm-hmm. think you don't need it. It's it's very beneficial. And it's allowing me to talk about it right now, to be honest, because otherwise I wouldn't really know even how to talk about it. But what's interesting is if I hadn't told you about like the grief I was going through with this record, you wouldn't necessarily know that's what I was going through, because the songs are very much just looking inward at myself. And there were songs that I wrote about my mom directly. Those songs didn't make it because those ones were like, oh, I don't think I can put this on the record. And, you know, maybe they will, hopefully I will feel comfortable releasing them at some point. But at that moment I was like, you know what? I think these ones are just for me. I'm just going to keep these ones for now. No one else is going to hear them. So other than those songs, this record's very much just basically just trying to control my own feelings, like saying, because I was in such a dark place, and I couldn't really control much of my own surroundings. So it was just kind of like, how can I better myself? How can I not be such like a miserable piece of shit all the time? Right? Because I was like, my wife was still working 10-hour days, and she was a ray of positivity all the time. And I felt like I was just like this cloud of darkness every day that was just like trying to, you know, both with just having not much to do because of the pandemic and my mom and everything. I just felt like I was just bringing people down all the time and bringing myself down all the time. So I think these songs were just me saying like, come on, dude, like you've got it pretty good here. Like let's zoom out a little bit and look at a lot of the good things in your life. And how can we get to a place where we start appreciating those things a little bit more? And I think the album does end up in a very positive, appreciative place. I've done a couple interviews where people have been like, whoa, dude, this album's fucking dark. But I actually feel like songs from Quiet Talkers were darker than this record, because I think this record was me just searching for the light, you know, instead of running towards the darkness, which I feel like I used to do a lot more in my songwriting. This one was trying to, you know, find the light. So to me, it's actually very positive. But yeah, so I
You talk about the apocalypse a lot on this album, but kind of playfully, like there's that lyric, the future is dead and there's no looking back. How are you thinking about the future? I mean, since 2020, because it sounds like you went from a place of like, let's dig down deep into some darkness to, oh shit, we're in the darkness. How do we find our way out? So with that in mind, like, are you still like an end times apocalyptic minded person?
I mean, a little bit. It's hard not to be with the way the world is right now in multiple factors, right? It's just, and that's what The Future is Dead is sort of about, is just like, we don't even know how the world's going to end, but we all kind of feel like it might be coming, but it could be multiple different things. But I think especially those first two apocalyptic songs on the record, they kind of get to this place of acceptance, which is like, you know, again, we can't control the impending doom that's coming. We can only control our own environment and how we interact with the people in our lives and how we appreciate the people in our lives. And so, you know, songs like The Big One or The Future is Dead, I do think they get to the place of acceptance and appreciation for, like, if we're going to go out, we're going to go out together. You know, I don't want to have any regrets.
Arm in arm.
Yeah.
Into the void.
Yeah. So I feel like even though I still have a doomsday mentality, it's still more, it comes from a place of, you know, at least trying to go out, you know, go out, find the high ground and go out on a high note, you know,
if
that makes sense.
Looking into the future, if you had to guess, maybe you already have some idea, what do you think your next record is going to sound like?
Normally, I would have written a bunch of songs by now, by the time, like, the album just came out a month ago. And normally, I'd already have a handful of songs for the next one. I have zero. So that's the first time I've been in that situation. So that's really interesting.
Oh my gosh, are you panicking? Are you feeling like free? Are you, sorry to plant even the thought of anxiety, but I just, since we do the same thing for a living, like whenever I have a period where I'm not writing, I'm like, well, the well is gone dry.
Yeah.
Better go to grad school for something I don't care about. Like, what's your plan?
It's a very good question. There's definitely some anxiety. I think the anxiety is more from just like, if this record goes nowhere and doesn't have a life like Quiet Talkers did, I need to come up with more songs very quickly. But I'm hoping that this record will have a bit of a longer life, that I, you know, I'll have some time, because I know that the, you know, I know the river will start flowing eventually. And when it does, it'll, you know, it'll happen fast. And in a way, I'm hoping that it's a good thing that I haven't, that I'm still very much in the world of Cerulean and I haven't really moved on from it yet. I think that'll probably bode well for the mm-hmm. next batch of songs. I just don't think I'm quite ready to tackle them yet. I'm finding that I have a lot of music written, but I don't have lyrics for anything yet. I'm finding the lyrics are not really coming yet, which to me tells me like I should just not force it. I should just kind of,
yeah,
you know, let it wait until they come, right? Because
yeah, I think staying in the present artistic moment is a gift you give your future self, because when you rush it, you end up having to undo a lot of half-assed stuff.
Absolutely.
So it's like an act of faith in your future creativity to just let it come when it comes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I, you know, I always have gone through dry periods. They just haven't mm-hmm. quite been this dry, but I have faith. I have faith that the songs will return at some point.
And enjoy Cerulean, because it's a beautiful record. And I mean, a lot of the reviews are saying this, but I also want to say it, that it's like, it's a courageous and fun record, and it sounds phenomenal.
Oh, thank you.
Ken Yates, you've been a great guest, a fascinating guest. Would you be willing to do a brief lightning round to close out our interview, where you don't think too hard and you just answer a few questions based on gut alone?
Let's do it.
Okay. Jeans or sweatpants?
Jeans.
What is your go-to pre-show drink?
Whiskey.
What type?
Bourbon.
Great. What is one song you wish you had written?
Ooh, Brian Dunn's I Hope I Can Make It to the Show. I love that song so much.
That's on my list as well. Yeah. That is a great
song. Another Brian shout-out. Sorry, Brian.
Hey, Brian. Action, comedy, drama, or romance?
Ooh, action. I love action movies.
I'm the same. What is one snack you always need to have in the tour van?
Triscuits. I love Triscuits. Ooh. Yeah, big Triscuits fan.
Fibrous.
My wife is celiac, so we can't have them in the house because they've got gluten in
Contraband.
Them.
Contraband.
Yeah, so out on the road, it's just nothing but Triscuits.
Wild. Planes, trains, or automobiles?
Automobiles. I like the freedom of the car.
Cool. What do you want done with your body when you die?
Cremated and spread in a lake somewhere.
Aw, nice. And what's one secret that Kathleen Edwards is keeping from the world?
Oh, that's a good one. I don't actually know Kathleen that well, but I don't know any of her secrets.
She featured on your album, and I love her so much that I was trying to catch you off guard and get you to reveal some spicy secret that we could use as like a basic folk scoop.
I don't think I have.
Shout out to Kathleen. So, yeah. She did such a cool feature on your album.
Yes, she's great. She's the best. I wish I had more of her secrets, but I don't. So your secrets
are
safe,
Kathleen.
Okay, we'll
get there. Ken, thank you so much for being on Basic Folk. Everybody go buy the album Cerulean and go see Ken on tour. Thanks again for being here.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by John Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can also search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk, or you can go to our website, basicfolk.com. And speaking of grace, Lizzie, today is a special day. It's your sister's birthday, and her name is Claire.
That's true. Claire Eleanor Quinlan, happy birthday to you. You're the best sister in the universe.
Yes. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.